Hello and welcome to the SEAI's 180 Degrees podcast. I'm your host, Sinead Ryan, and over the course of the next 12 episodes, I'll be joined by special guests to talk about the state of play of Ireland's energy revolution, how we can be smarter energy users, what renewable technologies are coming into our homes and communities, and how small businesses can benefit from decarbonising now. Hello, and you're very welcome along to episode 12. Over the past 11 episodes, we've discussed in a great amount of detail the actions that people can take in their homes, communities, and businesses to reduce energy use, save money, and adopt a more energy efficient lifestyle. We have talked about some of the key technologies that are likely to have widespread benefits and enable our transition to a fossil-free future. But the evidence says we also need to pick up the pace and take further action to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. In January this year, the EPA launched its first climate change assessment report. The report provides a comprehensive assessment of our understanding of climate change in Ireland and our response to this global crisis. And earlier this month, EPA published a second report on climate in the Irish mind, a national survey on climate attitudes in Ireland. And we will get onto that a little bit later. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Eimear Cotter, Director of the Office of Evidence and Assessment at the EPA, who's going to talk to us about some of the key findings within these reports, what they're telling us exactly, and also how we can prepare for the scale of the challenge ahead for Ireland to become climate resilient. Eimear, you're very welcome along.
Thank you.
To this final episode in the series. So I suppose what I really want to get started with perhaps is an overview. I've had a read of these reports and I have to say they are stark. Mm-hmm. They're startling. They're certainly worrisome, but they're also filled with some hope that there is still much to do, but that we can actually do it. So talk me through the first one, the climate change assessment report. This was very substantial report. Tell me why you set out to do it and then a little bit about what you found.
So our Ireland's climate change assessment report is published by the EPA in January of this year, and it is a comprehensive state of the scientific knowledge on climate change in Ireland. So our understanding of climate change, how it pertains to Ireland, what we need to do to tackle climate change, how we need to adapt to a changing climate, and the opportunities and the benefits within that. And it very much complements global assessments that are carried out every 6-7 years by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, so the IPCC. So every 6-7 years, they carry out a major global assessment of climate change. We now have taken that science and looked at it, focusing in on what's happening in Ireland, giving more depth in an Irish context. And we did that, EPA funded it, with 22 academics from a wide variety of third level institutions around Ireland, and with funding from SEAI, SFI and Department of Transport. And it giving us, I mean, the top line conclusion is that climate change is happening. It is now a reality in Ireland. We have a way to go in terms of reducing our emissions and adapting to a changing climate. And we're already seeing that. But there are opportunities and there are benefits for us if we can get on the right track.
Now, in terms of what we know has happened, so there's a certain amount of climate change that has occurred and is now in the past, mm-hmm. and maybe not that we can do a lot about it. Mm-hmm. So we've seen that, or maybe some people will have seen evidence of that in changing weather patterns, mm-hmm. flooding. We only have to look at low-lying parts of Ireland. We are an island nation that have experienced more frequent flooding and to a greater extent than ever before. We've seen changing weather patterns. What other things do we absolutely know are as a result of climate change?
So first, briefly, if you just take a step back, we know from the science that our greenhouse gas emissions, so CO2 emissions, are at the highest levels that they've been in our atmosphere for millions of years. And that's mainly from combustion of fossil fuels. other powerful greenhouse gas emissions like methane, N2O, are higher than they've been for about 800,000 years. So these are three of the main greenhouse gas emissions, not the only ones. They trap heat. They've been increasing in our atmosphere and they're heating up our atmosphere so that globally we're seeing temperatures have gone up by 1 degree on pre-industrial levels. So 1 degree mightn't sound like a lot to you and me, but that is actually bringing quite a lot of change within our climate system and exacerbating climate extremes and bringing unprecedented changes into our land, our oceans, our atmosphere. And we're seeing that play out in terms of extreme weather events around the world and here in Ireland. So those global temperature rises that we're seeing, 1 degree around the world, they're also happening in Ireland. So we have a 1 degree temperature rise in Ireland on pre-industrial levels. And that bringing with it a changing climate. So we're seeing more extreme weather events. 15 of the 20 warmest years in Ireland have happened since 1990. And we're getting a better understanding in recent years of how climate is playing into extreme weather events. So, for example, in recent weeks, there's been a major study done on looking at the contribution that climate change has made to the Middleton floods. There was flooding, if you remember, in Middleton last October during Storm Babette. There they had a month's rainfall over 2 days. The river burst its banks, €200 million of damage done to people's homes and businesses, untold damage and heartbreak for those people. So these scientists from Maynooth University, Met Aaron and Imperial College looked at how much did climate change play into this. And they found that that weather event was twice as likely to have happened with global temperatures as they are now. And that the rainfall in particular was 13% more intense as a result of climate change. So we're really seeing the impact of climate on these, on these events.
So for the remaining few, if any, sceptics out there who say we've always had flooding of the Lee and we've always had flooding and rain and wet and we're Ireland and this kind of thing happens all the time. What would you say to them to say, look, this we've always had snow, we've always had heat, we've always had floods. Is it that we are seeing it more often now when you talk about, you know, the 15 hottest years, or is it that the events themselves are getting more extreme?
It's both, actually. So the frequency and the intensity, and the science is evolving all the time to be able to show the contribution that climate change is making on these extreme weather events. So, for example, in 2022, we had a heat wave in that year. You might remember it was very, very hot over that summer of 2022. Consistent science and evidence showing that climate change is playing a part in that. The highest temperature records, modern day temperature records in Ireland were reported that year, 33 degrees in Phoenix Park. London had temperatures of over 40 degrees. I was actually in London that time. It was extremely warm, but consistent evidence showing that climate change is playing into these events. So if there is any doubt, and I know we're going to go on and talk about climate change in the Irish mind, Irish people by and large recognise that our climate is changing and recognise that climate change is playing into these extreme weather events in a very real way.
Indeed, and I suppose we are fortunate. We don't always consider ourselves fortunate weather-wise in Ireland, but we are fortunate because of the latitude that Ireland exists on, that the 1% or the 2% degree change, you know, if that were to happen, and it is happening in the middle of Africa, or in Australia, or in very, very dry countries that are already extremely hot, then that has a, you know, an immediate and catastrophic effect. Does it take a little bit longer to arrive at our shores if it's temperature? I mean, I saw a report recently where Swedish scientists had said that even though the last decade was warmer than any in the last 100 years, that there's a possibility places like Ireland could get colder. We might end up with more Arctic temperatures. So it's just the whole thing is haywire. Is that it?
And the temperature increase is driving many different changes. So for us in Ireland, it's a 1 degree temperature rise we're seeing in line with the global averages. That is driving more intense rainfall. So 7% more intense rainfall in Ireland over the last 30 years compared to the previous 30. Looking out beyond what's happening then in nature, we will see issues increasingly happen around invasive species, threatening native species in Ireland, impacts on coastal communities, looking at storm surges, coastal erosion, the impact on the agricultural system as a result of these changing climatic conditions, and on our infrastructure. So the temperature increase is what we talk about a lot, but that is driving so many changes that we will also experience here in Ireland.
Yeah, and we certainly have seen anybody in the middle of summer, you know, a lot more insects maybe that are unusual, birds that are migrating places they hadn't before, you know. So nature kind of picks this up before maybe us, who are supposed to be the highest in the food chain, get to grips with it. Yeah. Now, in this report, which is the Climate Change Assessment Report, and I would encourage people to actually read it. We will put up a link to it and the one we're going to come on to, the Irish Mind Report, at the end of the episode so you can have a read of it. It's very clear. What it did say was that even though it is believed that some of the elements of climate change, greenhouse gases, peaked in 2001, all sectors have shown reduced emissions of late, with the exception of agriculture. Now, this bugbear comes up time and time and time again because agriculture forms such a massive part of our economy. Mm-hmm. They're a very vocal lobby group with government. There's a lot of state aid goes their way, and indeed EU aid. And yet they are way above the EU average, and it has not come down to any great extent. One of the solutions put forward is that we need a lot more forestry and a lot more land developed for forestry. We currently have about 8,000 hectares per year, and we're looking at needing 35,000. It's a bit like the housing crisis. Eimear, what would you say to farmers?
So agriculture is the largest source of our emissions in Ireland, responsible for 38% of our emissions. And that actually, we're unusual in the EU in that regard.
So I mean, that's more than you and me and all the people out there. It's more than the building industry. It's more than Ryanair. It's massive.
It is a large contribution, but it doesn't let any other sector off the hook. And really, I think if we get into the situation when we're talking about climate, where we're pointing fingers or attributing blame to any one particular sector, we will find ourselves, I'd say, in a very difficult spot. So agriculture is a significant source of emissions, as is energy. And I will go on and talk about energy as well, about transport, heating, residential. 38% for emissions from agriculture. We are different from when we compare ourselves to others in the EU. The average is about 10%. And that's reflective of the really important role that agriculture plays in our economy. So we have a different emissions profile in Ireland compared to other EU countries, and that means our response needs to be different. So the ambition for the agricultural sector, and this comes from their food vision policy and in the climate action plan, is to have a climate neutral agricultural system by 2050. So what does that mean? You see this set out in many different policy documents, is that an increasingly diversified sector, not just reliant on livestock, but actually diversifying into other areas like organic farming, tillage and more tillage, forestry. You mentioned forestry. So the levels of forestry the ambition is to get to 8,000 hectares per annum, and that's way off where we are now. So we need to see more forestry where the forests and trees will absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. So there's a lot of research and a lot of innovation happening in the agriculture sector, be it food additives, which are not mainstream at the moment but are under research, be it new fertilisers, new nutrient ways of managing nutrients, all of which are in a demonstration phase or in a research phase that need to actually now go out into the mainstream, be taken up by farmers. Farmers will need to be supported to do that. I mean, if these, for example, food additives are just too expensive at the moment for mainstream use. So farmers will need to be supported to do that.
We need to stop the cows belching so much, is that it? And emitting from both ends, because it's messing up rivers and fields and soil and all that kind of thing. And of course, adding methane.
It is impacts from greenhouse gas emissions, from ammonia emissions and on water quality. But there are others. The energy system is really important that we don't lose sight of our energy system either. I mean, COP28, the end of last year in Dubai, was a historic agreement, heralded the beginning of the end for fossil fuels. That is going to be a significant challenge here in Ireland. We're 86% dependent on fossil fuels. And that's despite all of the progress that we've made in power generation and electricity generation. So over 40% of our electricity has come from renewables last year. So that's really positive. But that is only bringing us so far, and we still have to tackle transport and heat. And I know you've talked about that a lot in this series.
We've had episodes on transport, on district heating coming on. Very exciting work being done in that area, and others as well, and data centres and all that kind of thing. So people can listen back to those if they want to. And I think your point is well made, you know, that nobody gets let off the hook on this, or hung on the hook entirely in that way, because we all have a part to play. Now, one of those parts to play is the role of technology and what is available. And we've talked a lot about energy efficiency and renewable energy and all that over the last 11 episodes of 180 Degrees. But we do need to do more faster. The report calls for deep, rapid, immediate and sustained emission reduction. That sounds very urgent. From your research, what do you think are the main barriers to increasing the pace of what we're already doing?
So one of the things we see most commonly in recent years is that we are seeing some progress in sectors. For example, in 2022, overall, our national greenhouse gas emissions reduced by just under 2%. So that's really good news. That's going in the right direction. And we have to acknowledge that. But to put that in context, what we actually need to see is reductions of 12% on average every year. Mm-hmm. So that's every year to keep within the carbon budgets and to reach our targets by 2030. So while 2% is really good, it is nowhere near where we need to be to keep within the carbon budgets and to hit our 51% reductions by 2030. Gosh. And what we're seeing, the progress that we're seeing in sectors is being eroded or wiped out by economic growth, which is predicated on fossil fuel consumption. So any good we're seeing over in one hand in different sectors is just being wiped out by a continually growing economy, which is predicated and built on fossil fuels. So we need to break that link. And we often say that, but we really do need to break that link now between economic growth, which we need for our economy, but to do that in a way based on clean, renewable energy and move away from fossil fuels.
Do you think that there are still a lot of people out there, and I think I'm one of them, who are still confused by the impact that what they can do? You know, they might feel, sure, look, I'm recycling, I'm using the new reuse scheme with my bottles, I make sure all the bins go out in the right order and with the right stuff in them, I'm trying to take the bus where I can or walk. I mean, you don't want a sense of hopelessness to land on people either, that they're saying, I'm doing all this, and yet, it's never enough and it's never fast enough. Are people confused or do they overestimate their actions and what they're doing?
Yes, and our latest work in climate change in the Irish mind gives us some really interesting results in this regard. So it's looking at people's behaviours in relation to climate change. And one of the things that's really obvious from this is that there is confusion about the impact of individual actions that we might take. So people understand, for example, that flying has an impact on climate. But yet when we look elsewhere, people look at the use of reusable shopping bags or recycling, as you mentioned, all really important, but overestimate the impact that these behaviours or these actions can have and underestimate the impact of other measures like dietary changes. So there's this confusion that people have about what should I do, number one, and if I do it, will it make any difference? And this can be quite paralysing for people and you end up where you have all of these good intentions, people really motivated to act, but yet not able to translate it into action because of this confusion.
So there's an education piece then to be done.
And that's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. We need to make sure that people have the information they need in an accessible way, that they can get at it, to make informed choices. So where somebody wants to do something for the climate and for the environment, and all of the analysis suggests people are very motivated to act, that they can get at that easily and make informed choices and
the right things rather than maybe the things that aren't going to have so much impact. So let's talk then about the second report, Eimear, because that's Climate Change in the Irish Mind. And this was effectively a survey of Irish people to find out where they're at in terms of the climate change argument, what they're doing personally, what they worry about, what they're happy about, all that kind of stuff. So some of the key findings, well, you talk me through some of the key findings. I have them here. You looked through a huge number of areas. National responsibility, or is the country doing enough? Whether people support current government policies, how the cost of living impacts on the decisions people make, you know, consumer behaviours, how much people actually know about climate change. So I found on reading this that there was a great deal of positivity, certainly in intention and awareness. So how did you interpret this report? And again, we'll put up a link to it, folks. It's publicly available. It'll be on the podcast there.
So this is phase two of our Climate Change in the Irish Mind project that we've undertaken with Yale University. And the results are really consistent with phase one, which we published about 2 years ago, showing widespread agreement on climate attitudes and majority support for climate action. So overall, the study was looking at people's beliefs, attitudes, behaviours and policy preferences in relation to climate, and came at that in a number of different ways in terms of the questions that people were asked to build up that very comprehensive and holistic understanding of what people think, feel and want to do on climate. And it's showing that there is a large amount of worry about climate change. 81% of us are worried about climate change, in particular worried about extreme weather events, severe storms, extreme heat, and that reflective of the fact, as we talked earlier, we are living in a changing climate. 89% of people feel personally impacted by climate change, or speaking about it frequently to their family and friends. Really important to be talking about this. Like, talk is not a substitute for action, but it is a precondition or a precursor for action.
And I suppose a lot of people now are used to having, if they've small kids, coming home from school and saying, oh no, mommy, don't put that in there, that belongs in the other bin, or don't throw this out, or we need to go out and feed the bees, or whatever.
Absolutely.
And they're actually, you know, that message is being impacted in households around the country because of the work that is going on in schools and places.
Those conversations at home or on the kitchen table with your friends are really important. This is relevant, it's salient in people's lives, and that's what we're seeing through this study. And that people want the government to prioritise climate action and see the benefits in doing that from an economic perspective in terms of job creation, but more in terms of the quality of life implications, that it will actually bring benefits to their local communities in terms of their local environment, as well as helping to tackle climate change.
Yeah, and we saw in the last episode, episode 11, and if you missed it, you can check it out now, where we spoke to community groups who are affecting super change at a very local level, supported by the SEAI and others to do it. And it was very, very interesting. Now, 40% or almost 40% of people think climate change is caused equally by human activities and natural causes. Is that right, Eimear?
No, that isn't right. So climate change is entirely caused by human activities. So I'll flip it. I'll say 60% of people understand that climate change is caused by human activities. But yes, nearly 40% of people thinking it's equally natural and man-made. And that is false. That is incorrect.
So the climate isn't changing by itself.
No, exactly. It is entirely caused by human activities. And that pointing to the fact that there still is this confusion. What are the root causes of climate change? It is man-made. There is work to be done there to help people understand that we are influencing our climate. Our actions will influence our emissions. And by helping people with that understanding, again, making sure they have the information, will motivate them to take the right actions and to be more climate conscious.
So if there are people listening to this pod now who are thinking, well, I'm doing my recycling, I have Meatless Monday, I walk to work, I think I'm doing enough, I think I'm doing the right things, what behaviours would you say to people, well, actually, you're not doing this, 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 or are there other things that everybody could do without great cost to them that would make a difference, even in an incremental way?
So if somebody is listening and doing all those things as you list them out, that's really good. That's great. And it's important to recognise that. Look, it's hard to point to one particular thing. There is no one silver bullet in this. What I do like to talk about is preventing food waste. And this is the climate action that we say in the EPA that somebody can take 3 times a day. So food waste is responsible for 10% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So if you prevent food waste, so think about what you're buying in the shops, go with the list, very practical advice, go with the list, look at your storage and don't actually generate the food waste in itself. That can have a large impact. And inevitably, there is going to be some food waste in every household. Where there is compost, to put that food waste into a brown bin. Now, people need a brown bin. So that's, this is important. Not everybody has a brown bin. We in the EPA have been consistent in saying every household should have a brown bin so that of that food waste that is generated, people can put it into the brown bin and it'll be composted and it won't go into landfill. So I just... That's the one thing I like to highlight to people. Okay. It's something that is relatively easy to do and you can do it 3 times a day.
So you can plan your meals, shop carefully, use up your leftovers.
Yeah. Don't go shopping when you're hungry. It's a good one.
Yeah. And that saves on the pocket as well, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
And use your freezer appropriately
that's
as well.
Yeah.
Probably don't throw out as much. I mean, I think we're all a bit guilty, especially with school-going kids, of finding the mouldy apples at the bottom of the fruit bowl and the lettuce going off and all that kind of thing. So it's only buying what you need and maybe avoiding, my top tip, avoiding the buy one, get an extra one free if you're actually not going to use it, if it's a perishable good, because it's no saving.
That's
really,
it. And to think through it, our analysis shows that the average household wastes about €700 a year in terms of buying food that's ultimately thrown out. Yeah. So there's a lot of saving in this.
It's so expensive at the moment, we could all do that with that back in our pockets. Now, in this, just to finish up, Eimear, then, in this report, you came across 4 audience types when it came to addressing climate change and how people perceive it. Mm-hmm. So just let's go through them. And you know, we all may be a bit of this, by the way, have a bits of all 4 of them. The first were the people who were most alarmed.
Mm-hmm. So these are 4 groupings that we identified in phase 1, and we need to update this now following what we published in the last week. But there are 4 groupings of people, and they're grouped based on their beliefs, their attitudes, and their policy preferences in relation to climate. So the first group is the alarmed. That's 36% of the population, that 1.3 million people. These are the people that are most convinced climate change are happening, understand that it's caused by human activity and that there's scientific consensus on it, are most worried about climate change, feel personally impacted by it, and want to see the government prioritise climate action. The next group are the concerned. So they're the largest group, 48% of the population, 1.7 million people. And again, very concerned about climate change, maybe not to the extent of the grouping alarmed, but still concerned about climate change, understand again that it's caused by human activities, are talking about climate change frequently to their family and friends, and want to see the government act on climate change. So between the alarmed and the concerned, that's 84% of the population. It's really important to just highlight that there 84% of
vast
Irish people,
majority, over 8 in 10 people
are falling into this either alarmed or concerned about climate change. So then there's 2 other areas. There's those that are in the cautious group. So that's 12%, a much smaller group, 400,000 people. And these, again, believe climate change is happening. We see the understanding of what's causing climate change breaking down in this group. So a third actually think it's caused by purely by natural causes, which is, as we've talked about, not correct. 50% thinking it's equally caused by man-made and human activity. Okay. So this group really not sure, would feel that their knowledge of climate change is not great, and are talking about it infrequently to their family and friends. And then the last grouping, the doubtful, this is the smallest group.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, 3% of people, 100,000 people. So it really
it's still
is
a lot
small.
Of people, yeah.
Yeah, I'd say it's small, but still 100,000 people. And this group really is where we see any climate scepticism, which is very small in Ireland, but where we see these people. So 50% of the people in this group still believe climate change is happening. That's important to say, even within the doubtful. So 50% still believe climate change is happening, 50% don't. And they're not worried about climate change. They don't feel personally threatened by it. They're not speaking about it to their family and friends. So for me, this group, so the point of this research really is to understand our audience. To be effective in terms of communication, you need to know who you're talking to. And by having these different groupings, you can target your message effectively. You can look at who the messenger is, who people are looking to for information, and make sure that our communication is effective in terms of encouraging people to improve their understanding, to take the necessary actions that need to be taken.
Which group do you fall into?
I'm definitely in the alarmed. I mean, you can't spend most of your career working in climate change without seeing the evidence right in front of us. But I think the remark I'd make is, in the climate change assessment report, it does say very clearly that our climate future is in our hands. And if we act now, we actually can stabilise a lot of the key parameters in our climate system, like temperature, like rainfall. And if we take early action now, if we reduce our emissions, keep the temperature rise to as close to 1.5 degrees as we can keep it to, that our climate system in Ireland will remain broadly recognisable to what we have today. So there's every imperative to act now and every reason to act now. And really, it's that message that the climate future is in our hands that came through very, very clearly from that
work. To be able to present this planet to our grandchildren and great-grandchildren as intact as we can.
Absolutely.
So by 2040, let's say, which actually isn't that terribly long away now, Eimear, if everything works out as best it can and we take our early action and our interventions that are required, how would you see us all living? I'm going to ask you to take out your crystal ball and just kind of paint us a word picture of how our homes will look, how we'll be travelling, and maybe how we'll be working and the farming community.
Well, I mean, the way I will answer that is to look at our climate action plan. So this isn't a like completely futuristic question. In fact, we have all of the plans laid out about where we need to be by 2030, if I take it to 2030. So if we look at our power generation system, our electricity, we'll have 80% of our electricity coming from renewables by 2030. That's our ambition, which means only 20% coming from fossil fuels. So we'll be well on our way to phasing fossil fuels out of our power generation system, that coming mainly from onshore wind. Offshore wind would be playing a much greater role, solar, for example. And that feeding in then to other sectors like the transport sector. We have an ambition to have nearly a million electric vehicles on our roads by then, powered by 80% renewable energy, more biofuels in our diesel, petrol cars, better public transport so that it's more attractive. And that's probably mainly an option for people who live in urban areas, and more active travel, safer, better cycling, walking facilities. In our homes, I mean, the ambition that's been set out for the residential sector, and SEAI are a huge part of that, means all our new homes will be built to really high standards. We'll have 500,000 homes retrofitted, will be more comfortable, warmer, more heat pumps on our system, and other technologies like district heating, biomethane also feeding in. And for the agriculture sector, it's about achieving that sustainable agricultural food system by 2050, ultimately, with significant progress having been made up to 2030, 2040. And that diversity, again, we'd hope to see in terms of not just livestock, but organics, more afforestation happening, some more forestry, the farming community playing a greater role in terms of the energy, delivering our energy ambitions, and looking at re-wetting where that makes sense to do that. So it's not what I think when I think about what's going to happen in the future, in 2040 is only 16 years away. It's not completely futuristic. We actually know quite a lot about what we need to do. We are starting on that way. We have a long way to go yet. But much of the plan is laid out in terms of particularly our climate action plan.
Well, thank you, Dr. Eimear Cotter, for joining us today with that. And for anyone's interested in digging deeper into those findings from each of those reports, which are excellent, we'll be adding links to download in the podcast notes. Eimear, thanks very much for that. And Eimear concludes our final episode of Series 5 of 180 Degrees, produced by the SEAI. It's been a fascinating journey for me to host these and talk to such experts that we've had across all 12 episodes. It has certainly changed my mind on quite a few things and opened my eyes to things, both very, very positive and things probably I could be doing a little bit better. So I'd like to thank all of the guests across the series. I'd like to thank the SEAI for sponsoring and supporting it. And I think that there is something for everybody in at least one or more of the episodes. So if you've missed one and you didn't get a chance to hear it, well then why not like and subscribe to this whole series, and then you won't miss any of them. And it's only left for me to say thank you for listening and goodbye.